This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Argo Studios in New York City. Ready or not, we're getting close to the end of 2011.
I believe that this movement of change cannot be turned back.
This virus is spreading throughout the Middle East.
And the trouble is, that's the image of the United States as blundering tourists in a very dangerous region, that they don't know what's going on.
Upheaval in the Middle East, and the West's understanding of it has been defined by Islam, by people who believe in it, by people who are afraid of it, and by people who use both the faith and the fear as political weapons. On this week's show, we'll take a broad look at how these themes have defined the year that's ending and how they're likely to influence global developments in 2012 with Haroon Mogal, a fellow at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding.
If it's an oxymoron to believe that people who no longer believe in God still need caring and community, then I'm pretty happy to be a walking oxymoron.
Another theme that has surfaced repeatedly on this show has been the growth of the interfaith community to include people of no faith. We've talked to a number of guests in the past year who identify as atheist or secular humanist, and I see a very encouraging trend toward mutual understanding between people of faith and people of no faith. And we're going to analyze all of that on this week's show with Greg Epstein, who serves as the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. But first,
some have suggested that gay rights and human rights are separate and distinct, but in fact, they are one and the same.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking at the UN in Geneva earlier this month. Strong words emphasizing the innate rights of all persons. Earlier, President Obama issued a memo directing agencies to, quote, protect vulnerable LGBT refugees and asylum seekers and leverage foreign assistance to protect human rights and advance non-discrimination. This was very big news. I want to talk today about the on-the-ground reality of daily life for oppressed sexual minorities in many parts of the world, the reality that the administration is now directly addressing. We have just the right person with whom to do that. A year ago, Reverend Pat Bumgardner, senior pastor of Metropolitan Community Church of New York, was with us in this studio to announce the birth of the Global Justice Institute, a nonprofit international human rights organization for which she serves as executive director and board chair. I'm very pleased to welcome Reverend Pat back to State of Belief Radio as we seek to contextualize the administration's efforts. Reverend Pat, thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
You travel a lot of places to where life is brutal for LGBT people. I would like for you, if you will, to talk about some of the situations that are going to be impacted by the administration's recent actions.
Well, I think there are many, many situations that are going to be impacted. I mean, the scope of both the president's announcement and then Secretary of State Clinton's speech involves a wide range of things. Much of what Secretary Clinton was addressing was the day-in and day-out suffering of LGBT people in their communities, in their nations of origin, in their families of origin. For example, this past year when my colleague Pastor Joseph Tolton and I traveled to Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda, we met with people who had been chased from their homes and their villages and lost their jobs only because somebody suspected that they were LGBT. And so they lost not only the roof over their head, but any means of surviving. And then what happens is local newspapers pick this story up and publish their faces, sometimes their names. And so they have no place to go. And what the president was addressing and what Secretary Clinton was addressing is the fundamental right that we have as human beings, not because of government policy, not because of political persuasion, not because of culture, not because of religious belief, but the right we have as human beings by virtue of the fact we are born. You know, we have the right to be safe. We have the right to work for a living. We have the right to be free from persecution and certainly from violence.
This announcement stunned me. Did you feel that way about it?
Well, the truth is that people have been working behind the scenes for a long, long time. I want to single out Secretary Clinton in particular. I mean, since the beginning of her tenure, she has been addressing this issue of the universality, is how I would like us to talk about it, the universality of human rights. And you cannot speak about universal human rights if you're singling out a particular sexual orientation or a particular gender identity or a particular religious conviction or, you know, women or children. And all of those groups actually are involved in the pursuit of LGBT rights. Many people tend to think of us as this segregated kind of anomaly almost. We're sort of odd. But in fact, when you're talking about women's rights, you're talking about LGBT rights. When you're talking about providing for the poor, you're talking about LGBT people. When you're talking about protecting children, you're talking about our children, children who are identifying as a minority.
Given your knowledge of the international community, where is it most urgent that this new doctrine, this new principle be applied?
It might be easier to say where it isn't most urgent.
Okay.
I think one of the really excellent things that Secretary Clinton did in her speech was say, this is not the United States preaching to anyone. In fact, in our own nation, she didn't use the statistic, but the truth is over 20 transgender people were murdered in our own nation this past year simply because of who they were. There was no other reason that anyone can identify. So she basically stepped up to the plate and said, this is something we all have to work on. The truth is there are 80 countries in the world that still, or over 80, that still criminalize just our existence, just being LGBT. And there are places like Nigeria, which is trying to not only criminalize our relationships, but criminalize those who recognize them. There are places like Russia right now that's trying to criminalize any positive statement about LGBT lives. So, for example, if I went there as an MCC minister and preached a sermon that said the Bible does not condemn us, that could be a criminal act. There are places where we could say more progress is being made, certainly in the United States. But overall, I just want to say that, in my opinion, those victories mean nothing if the women I know in Pakistan can't simply go out to the market to buy food for their household without fearing that someone's going to think they're a lesbian and decide that they should be the victim of a, quote, honor killing. Those victories mean nothing to me if people in China, creating a blog or something for LGBT rights are subject to some kind of criminalization or imprisonment. So I think the imperative of Secretary Clinton's speech was that we all look at this in the bigger framework, from the bigger perspective, and see what we are doing every single day. That was her last point in her speech, that we should all ask ourselves what our part is in promoting universal human rights. And I think for LGBT people, our part is to see this as a global phenomenon and to see every step we take as something that is for all of us.
I have to say that you have just articulated the best perspective on that that I've heard, and I appreciate that. Pat, is there going to be conflict internationally about this?
I think there will be a lot of rhetoric that's kind of tossed around, mm-hmm. and people will be kind of beating their chests about, you know, this is my country or my government, or mm-hmm. you don't tell us what to do. But I think the bottom line is that most people of goodwill will understand the context in which these remarks were made and understand them as supportive of a broader global vision. I think people on the ground in countries who are working to curtail the spread of HIV or AIDS will see this as supportive of what they're doing, no matter who's funding them. So I think most thinking people on the ground in universal cultural context will understand the broader vision here.
Do you think it's true that there will be some situations in which the leadership will continue their mean-spirited rhetoric about the LGBT community, but also quietly be sure that the laws of the land are more in compliance with the vision of President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton?
I think you've just described how most governments, including our own, work on a daily right. basis. So I absolutely think that's true. And I think a case in point is Uganda, which has mm-hmm. continued its rhetoric but not really made substantial progress. And we hope they don't, of course. So I think that's a great example.
Well, and you know, here on State of Belief, as well as the Interfaith Alliance itself, we want to change heads and hearts. But if you don't get the heads and hearts changed, you try to get a law that makes people behave whether they're ready to or not.
Correct. And, you know, there are at least two schools of belief here. Secretary Clinton, toward the end of her speech, said the importance of changing laws is that those laws then shape culture.
Right.
And there are others who believe that it's a more, ground up kind mm-hmm. of thing. You work from the bottom up. I think what we have to do is just work from every position we have open to us and hope that it meets on yeah. higher ground, so
and
to speak.
We have to take what we get.
Exactly.
Not be satisfied with that.
Never be satisfied, yes.
Well, tell our people how they can find out more about the work of the Global Justice Institute.
Well, you can find out more in several ways. You can go to www.mccchurches.org and click on our Global Justice page.
And if you forget all of that or didn't get to write it down quickly enough, go to State of Belief's website and we'll help you get in touch as well. I'm talking with Reverend Pat Bumgardner, Executive Director and Board Chair of the Global Justice Institute. It's a nonprofit international human rights organization. She's also the senior pastor at Metropolitan Community Church of New York. Reverend Pat, it's always good to see you, and I really appreciate what you've done for us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We've got to take a short break now, but coming right up, I'll be joined by Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard University, for a look at the progress being made in cooperation and mutual understanding among people of faith and people of no faith. Later in the show, Haroon Mogal will be with us to talk about how the Muslim and non-Muslim worlds are misunderstanding each other and who benefits when they do. And a reminder, extended versions and transcripts of most all of our interviews are available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. This year, as always, there's been no shortage of contentious rhetoric on the part of the religious right in this country, leveraging every opportunity to claim that an anti-faith secular culture is all but done wiping out America's Christian roots. Whether it's the annual war on Christmas nonsense or apocalyptic warnings whenever a step is taken in the direction of reproductive or LGBT rights, the loudest voices always seem to be those of unrelenting absolutists. And it's no wonder that in this climate there have been some provocative and confrontational actions taken by beleaguered atheists as well. Far less noisy, but potentially far more significant, has been a growing level of cooperation among religious and non-religious people. I've seen it happening in the interfaith community. And to look at this trend more deeply, I'm happy to be joined by Greg Epstein, who serves as the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, and he is the best-selling author of Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton.
I think it'd be good to start by briefing our listeners on what it means to be a humanist chaplain, in case that's an unfamiliar term for some.
Sure. Working with humanists, atheists, agnostics, and the non-religious to build community that we can come together in to express our values, to express what we believe and not just disbelieve. So the idea that humanism is good without God, but that we shouldn't just focus on as humanists on the without God part of that. We should really build positive institutions to represent what we think is good about humanity, what is good and worthwhile about this world that we live in.
You were ordained as a humanist rabbi by the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism. What is that all about?
The idea of ordination as a humanistic rabbi is that I can have my culture, my identity, my heritage, and that for me is Jewish culture, Jewish identity. You know, there's some real importance to that for me, and actually it became more important when I realized that that can be my culture, but that my philosophy of life can be something different entirely. And so my philosophy of life is humanism. But I really believe that there's something important about having, the ability to combine humanist philosophy with all the other things about us that make us human besides just our beliefs. And, you know, you start to see this more often. There are humanistic Jewish congregations and communities all over North America. But increasingly, you're now starting to see groups coming together of African-American humanists or Latino humanists, or even humanists of Muslim cultural background.
I'd like to ask if you're also seeing a growing impulse toward cooperation and mutual understanding between people of faith and people of no faith, as I am seeing it in various interfaith settings.
Yes, I think that this is a huge trend. There's an increasing acknowledgement among religious communities that the non-religious and humanists and atheists and agnostics, that we are coming together as a movement, and we're only going to continue to grow. And so, to me, the smart leadership within the religious world is the leadership that is reaching out to us as a humanist movement and saying, we want to work with you. But by the same token, to me, some of the best leaders that I know of within the humanist movement and the secular movement are also saying, look, religion isn't going away anytime soon, and even more importantly than that, the fact is that most religious people can work with us, and that there's so much common ground to be explored that we often ignore. And so there are all kinds of collaborative projects. At Harvard, we've developed an initiative called the Values in Action Initiative, or VIA, which is meant to formalize that and say, we humanists are going to work on our own campus and in our own community to bring together collaborators across religious and humanistic lines.
We'll continue with Greg Epstein, humanist chaplain at Harvard University, in just a minute. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Greg Epstein is our guest. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. And we're talking about the growth of respectful cooperation among people of no faith and people of faith and the promise that offers for the future. Greg, how do you interpret the growing cooperation between people of faith and no faith? Where do you think this impulse is coming from, and why is it so important?
The first thing I would say is that as this non-religious movement or secular movement becomes more conscious of the fact that it does have positive values and it does have the potential to influence the world in a positive way, people start asking themselves, well, how are we going to do that? And one of the most natural ways is to say, well, look, can we find allies? Can we find partners? People that maybe don't agree with us on everything, but agree with us on some of the core things that we would like to see as changes in the world. And I think we found those allies, Welton, in folks like you and, in your organization and in some of the other organizations, interfaith organizations that we find ourselves working with around the country and around the world. So that's number one. It's just sort of a self-awareness. Then number two, as we build critical mass, it's new projects that are emerging and the stories that are emerging around them. So for us, it became really clear when we had the opportunity to get involved in some of the interfaith initiatives that we did. We nominated a student whose name is Chelsea Link. She is a senior here at Harvard College, wanted to get involved in humanism, but was also interested in, fascinated by religion. We nominated her to take part in some interfaith initiatives through an organization like the Interfaith Youth Corps, and then just to get involved in interfaith work on campus in general here. And she became, as a humanist and as the officer, and as an officer in the Harvard Secular Society, our student group here, the president of the Harvard Interfaith Council. And so here, finally, we had a humanist student, an active humanist student leader, as the president of the Harvard College Interfaith Council. And lo and behold, during this past year, while that was the case, the Interfaith Council had one of its most active years ever. I've been working with that group for the past 7-8 years now, and it's really never been at quite the height that it is today. Chelsea has just been this great example of the fact that you can have a humanist student who's so passionate about working with people across different lines, and she's organized huge events, whether it was a counter-protest for the Fred Phelps folks or several huge community service events around campus or interfaith speak-ins and teach-ins. And it's just been great.
Just to be sure that everybody understands, there are, though, great challenges facing an inclusive global interfaith movement. What do you think heads that list?
Well, I think the fact is that we have to be able to cooperate and collaborate while not feeling like we need to paper over our differences or ignore them or pretend that it's all just sing around and singing kumbaya, right? That even here with the Harvard chaplains, my colleagues at Harvard, we do collaborate increasingly, but lately, I've been one to say, and others as well have been one to say, let's make sure that we're getting some debates in as well. Let's make sure that we're not forgetting that there are real meaningful theological differences, and we need to talk about them. And one of the big challenges is that even many people in, for example, in the humanist world, who otherwise would really get on board with the kind of projects that folks like you and myself would work together on, resist those projects because they think that in order to get involved with religious folks, they've got to somehow check their humanist or atheist philosophy at the door. And it's just not right. So, you know, it's, in one way, it's sort of a PR issue. You know, it's making sure that we're reminding people this is about finding common ground and emphasizing the common ground, not ignoring the rest of it. You know, I would imagine on the religious side, there might be people who would say, well, I don't want to work with those humanists because they have such different beliefs than I do about the nature of the universe, about human origins or whatever. Those guys too, maybe we can do a better job of saying, let's work together on a project-to-project basis. Let's work together to preserve secular government and freedom of religion for all. Let's work together to fight for the best possible education for our children, including good education about science, which I think the majority of religious people want in this country. The more that we get caught up in sort of the red herring part of the debate, the less we're going to get done on a practical level.
Well, you're very wise. No one ought to have to leave their convictions behind in order to engage in meaningful dialogue. And I appreciate you pointing that out. Greg, as you speak this time of the year, what is your message at the close of this year and the start of a new year?
I think the message for us at this time of year as humanists is one of light and one of community. First of all, on a very basic level, it's getting cold, it's getting dark, and that's why all of the major religious holidays in this part of the world at this time of year focus on light. Lighting Hanukkah candles, lighting up the tree, giving presents, it's a way of acknowledging that seasonal affective disorder is real. And we need to come together and inspire one another when otherwise the physical nature of the world we live in would be getting us down. I mean, it's not that complicated. And that's the part that I love about these holidays and everybody loves about these holidays. You get together with the people you love and you make the world a brighter place in its darkest days. And along with that, humanists, I think, are increasingly realizing that part of what we need in order to do that is to have communities of our own, that there's something inspiring about going to a church or a synagogue at this time of year for even a lot of humanists, because it's this beautiful environment and it's people coming together to do meaningful things with meaningful music and art and that sort of thing. And so we've created a new project called the Humanist Community Project. We've got a new website that people can go to if they go to humanistcommunityproject.org or harvardhumanist.org that's exploring what would it look like at this time of year and at all times of year, if humanists got together more often to create alternatives to that religious community environment so that our communities could be stronger when we did partner in interfaith settings, and so that we could have our own ways of celebrating at this time of year. And so if you go to that site, you'll see a number of ideas for how we can observe this time of year and how we can come together more effectively in general.
Oh, that's so well said. Greg, I'm not displeased that there are some folks that, at least for now, are going to be uncomfortable with the whole premise of interfaith cooperation among people of faith and humanists. This kind of thing takes time, and that's okay. I do believe that if any one group had all the answers, surely we would have all noticed it by now. I think that it's far more likely that each belief system brings a crucial piece of the puzzle to the table, and that only together can we finally take some steps forward in this contentious and often violent world. Greg Epstein is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. He's the best-selling author of Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Greg, I really appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure, Welton. Thank you so much.
Coming up right after this break, Haroon Mogal, who has traveled and written extensively on the state of the Middle East and the disconnect between how we see people there and how they see us. It's a fascinating discussion. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. See you in just a moment. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Several times in this past year, we've been fortunate enough to be able to call on our next guest when his articulate insights were needed to help interpret breaking news impacting the Islamic and non-Islamic worlds. Each time, it felt like we were missing out on deeper and more broad understanding. So as the year comes to a close, I wanted to invite Haroon Mogul back on the show to share a more comprehensive overview of the places he's been, the insights he's gained in the past year. Haroon, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to ask you, if you will, to start by just talking about your work and about the observations that you've made in the course of that work.
Sure. So I think actually one of the neat things about the timing of this, December 17th, will be the 1 year anniversary of the attempted suicide of Mohamed Bouazizi, and he was the guy who in rural Tunisia last year lit himself on fire after an incident with a police officer, and essentially kind of sparked the Arab Spring, and everything went from there entirely unexpectedly, catching pretty much everyone from analysts and academics all the way on up to governments entirely off guard. It's been a year now. Three governments have gone down. One in Morocco has seen quite a few reforms to head off going down. And there's a conflict in Bahrain. There's a conflict in Yemen. There's a conflict in Syria. So really what he started and what his self-immolation expressed, I think, has shaken the whole region. And I think in turn has actually shaken the rest of the world.
Is the Muslim community better off or worse off?
I think it's better off. It has opened the door to a lot of positive things, and it has opened the door to a lot of conversations that need to happen. Unfortunately, the Middle East, and especially the Arab world, were the least democratic parts of the Muslim world. But sometimes in the United States, we tend to confuse the Arab world for the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
So insofar as I think it's changed the impression of Arabs and Muslims in America, it's a great thing. It's also changed conversations inside the Muslim world and created some breathing room. And now that people aren't just having abstract conversations, but they're having real debates with real implications for their societies, I think you're going to start seeing a much healthier, a much more normal, a much more intelligent political discourse. When you're outside of power and all you can do is really articulate things without any chance of putting them into practice and without any need for accountability, then the discourse you're going to see is going to be more extreme. It's going to be more cynical.
We would have to agree that though a lot of progress has been made, there's still some big disconnects. What false notions of each other mislead Muslims in the Middle East and non-Muslims in the West and shape what they believe? And what are the dangers of that?
Certainly. That's a great question. And I would say, generally speaking, Muslims in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, know more about the United States and vice versa. That's only because we're culturally dominant. You can't run a news show anywhere in the world without talking about the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You can't watch TV without encountering American culture, American movies and themes and ideas. So in that sense, America is probably better known. But there are a lot of misconceptions. When you talk to a lot of people in the Middle East and the Muslim world, one thing that surprises them is religiosity, for mm-hmm. example, because if your only engagement with the United States is through media, media tends to be pretty anodyne, right? Pop media, entertainment, mm-hmm. movies, music, deliberately don't talk about religion because that's not going to sell. You want to do something that's not going to offend or potentially inflame your audience. So people do tend to get a little bit surprised that America has a very healthy, vigorous religious life while also having a secular state. And I think for a lot of people, that's pretty surprising. I think from the American side of things, one of the biggest problems is this tendency to lump everyone into one category. All Arabs are one thing. All Muslims are one thing. And alongside that, to see Islam as immediately dangerous or problematic. So if there's any kind of Islamic party or movement, the assumption is that these guys are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very different types of Islamic parties and movements.
The way many Americans view Muslims generally and certainly Muslims in the international community depends on what newscast they watch. What kind of counsel would you give to better, more egalitarian reporting on the Muslim community?
What we need is an attempt on the part of journalists, but really actually their bosses, their employers, their sponsors, the ones who are paying their salaries, to emphasize nuance and depth. In the United States, for example, we see that the political conversation is really narrow. If anyone goes a little bit too far to the left or too far to the right, they're not engaged with, they're immediately dismissed. You don't have to agree with them, but there is some common sense of engagement and dialogue that doesn't take place. You can look at what's happened to Ron Paul, for example. I mean, every poll, he's always in the top three, and yet people will go from Herman Cain to Newt Gingrich to Michelle Bachmann, and Ron Paul never gets mentioned. And I think with the Muslim world, it's the same thing. There's a tendency to just look at things through binaries, the Islamists versus the secularists, the good Muslims versus the bad Muslims, the safe Arabs versus the dangerous Arabs, and to not really introduce the kind of nuance that we need to understand what's happening.
Would most Muslims not in the United States view most Americans in a way that would surprise most Americans?
I think so. I think, you know, there are certainly strong criticisms of American foreign policy. There are strong disagreements. And the injection of religion into American politics has in turn poisoned the discourse in ways that didn't exist, for example, before the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So people talk about the issue of theocracy in the United States. And it's kind of funny because when you watch some of these analysts and reporters and commentators in the Arab world talk about evangelical Christianity in the United States, they're a little bit disbelieving because many of them tend to be liberal or simply would have never assumed that they would see this kind of religious politics coming out of a Western nation. At the same time, something I've heard very often from the vast majority of Muslims outside of our country tend to be able to differentiate between government policy and popular opinion and action and reality. So we like Americans, but we disagree with your foreign policy. We like Americans, but we don't like this aspect of your government. And that's a very sophisticated way of approaching the world, and I think it's something that we can also get more of as we get more intelligent analysis of what's going on in other parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. In light of all that we've talked about, since we're coming toward the end of a year, what would be the most important step forward that we could take this next year related to a greater mutual understanding and support between these worlds?
I actually would like to see more Muslims attempting to engage people on the right, and I would love to see more people on the right attempting to engage Muslims. I think what's really needed is crossing those boundaries and getting outside of those boxes. It's really hard if your universe is shaped by a certain type of media to really know what's happening outside of that media. We have all this access. You can get your news on your phone and your tablet and your laptop and your TV and all these different sources, but still, nevertheless, we're restricted to whatever we choose to watch and listen to. In light of that fact, I think we need to make more of an effort as people who are aware of what's going on in different parts of the world or who have specializations in certain fields, to really jump into other boxes and to try to engage other audiences. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be a long-term thing. But I think in the year to come, it's going to be really important, especially considering that this is going to be an election year and there's certainly a lot on the line.
Haroon Mogal is an associate editor at Religion Dispatches, a fellow at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, and a PhD candidate at Columbia University. An additional step towards understanding that, I would suggest, is to read his writing on a regular basis. And Haroon, I am, as I've said, grateful that you were able to take time to be with us again today on State of Belief Radio. Thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, to hear extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices, so you can listen anywhere, anytime. I hope you'll share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. Let me encourage you, please, to tell others about this show. I hope you will encourage them to listen. I'd like for us to begin a national conversation or continue one, as the case may be. State of Belief Radio will find its greatest fulfillment in civil dialogue about the most important issues in our society, and you can be a part of that. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can become a member of the Interfaith Alliance also today at interfaithalliance.org. Now join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Know it's going to be a busy weekend for many of you, but I guarantee you it's worth taking time to listen to the show that we have for you next week. Our guest will include Bishop John Shelby Spong, whose new book is Reclaiming the Bible for a Non-Religious World. And we'll also get a year-end roundup of religion news from Kevin Ekstrom. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.